Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
It's very nice of you to be here. Thank you for coming. This is the third of our breathing space modules. Can I ask how many people have been to one of these already? Anybody hasn't? Oh, good. All right. Now, I did have some technology. I was a bit technology reliant, and it's testing my levels of joy at the moment. Because I'm pretty sure it's not going to work. So we'll just turn it off and see how we go. Now, this means that the morning is going to impose on your quality of attention, and it's going to impose on you a stronger than usual requirement to stay focused, because that was the excitement. And now we're going to start looking at joie de vivre. Now, it's a French expression, and the French didn't invent joy. They gave us soupe de jour, ménage à trois, Inspector Clouseau, but they didn't give us joy. Up until a few weeks ago, I didn't realise that the expression Mardi Gras was a French expression. Did anybody know? I suppose if I had a thought about it, I would have realised it's French. They're French words. But you know what it means? You know what it refers to? Mardi is Tuesday. And Mardi Gras is an official church calendar event. It's the Tuesday before Lent begins. So the idea is that at Mardi Gras, on Pancake Tuesday, Fat Tuesday, you eat up a lot before you go into austerities. It's come a long way since its original usage, and as Inspector Clouseau would say, zut alors. It is extraordinary. But that's how words change. Joie de vivre. Now, sometimes that expression is shortened to joie de vie. I think the usual understanding of that is joie de vie, but the full expression is joie de vivre. And it means living joy. Joie de vie has been understood as appetite, as love of sensual pleasure, but it actually means living joy. Now, we've got a lot of words in English that correspond to that, and we're not going to get into a linguistic analysis, but just hold in mind, joie de vivre is living joy. Joy is the goal of every human being. Every one of us has come into the world for the sake of discovering joy. That's why we're here. For the sake of discovering joy. A newborn child arrives and carries with it a wake of joy. So full of joy is it as it comes that everybody around it is infected with the same joy, touched by it, like a wave. So we've come into the world for the sake of discovering joy, and we spend our entire lives looking for it in some form or another. Happiness, pleasure, bliss. Well, how's it going? What would you say? Would you say that you've actually achieved your life's purpose? Steady, stable, constant joy? So there's a dysfunction between the reason we came into the world and our current experience. And what we're going to look at this morning, hopefully, with a little bit of effort, is what that dysfunction is and how that dysfunction can be rectified. Breathing space modules are about wonder. Philosophy, as Plato said, starts with wonder, and it works like this. You start by wondering about things, or you could start in just a mute, silent wondering at the mystery of something. But in any case, philosophy begins in wonder. It proceeds through a reasonable, practical inquiry, and if it works, it ends in a state of silent admiration. Wonder as silent admiration. So wonder is the beginning of philosophy, and wonder usually expresses itself in questions. Now, we've done this every one of the breathing space talks we've had, and that will be the standard practice. We're going to start with some questions, and see where they lead us. Now, the very best questions are living things. They're not dead inquiries about information. They're living things. And as living things, the best thing about them isn't the answer. It's the entertainment of the question. The best question is one which doesn't provide us with an immediate answer, but it opens up to possibilities. They brush away the settled dust of all our knowing and all the information that we've accrued over the years until we get to the thing that we're wondering about itself. So good questions open our minds. So don't worry about finding answers to these questions, just hear them and see where they go. Let them open our minds. I'll give you plenty of time to consider these. First one, is joy a purely personal experience? Does it include others? Or is it purely personal? How many forms, shapes, appearances does joy have? Is there a particular catalogue of joy shapes, and it's limited to that? Which is best? To receive joy from something or someone, to receive joy from something or someone, to give joy to something or someone, or to discover joy with others? Which is best? Second, can you recall the first time you discovered joy? Not such an easy thing, but can you recall the first time? Not the most recent, but the very first time you discovered joy. Did someone have to teach you how to discover joy? Did you have to learn it? Or is it something that's innate, inherent in you? Where does joy come from? Third, looking at relative states of joy, is it more joyous to acquire knowledge? And that can be quite a joyful thing, acquiring knowledge. Is it more joyous to acquire knowledge or to gain understanding? Which is more joyous? Is it more joyous to receive a gift or to express gratitude? Which is more joyous? Is it more joyous to suffer adversity or to overcome it? Is it more joyous to plant a tree or see it grown? What about pleasure? Is pleasure the same as joy? Pleasure is limited to the five senses. Is joy limited? Is it the same? Can you feel joy with your eyes closed, silent, with no information coming in from the senses? Is joy limited, like pleasure, to the senses? What about happiness? Is happiness the same as joy? It's a different word. Is it the same as joy? What do they have in common? Where do they meet? Where does joy meet with happiness, or happiness meet with joy? Is joy simply living happiness? And what about bliss? Is bliss the same as joy? No. this is a completely different word. How does bliss look? What's it feel like? What's it taste like? What's it sound like? Is bliss different from joy? Is it maybe just big joy? How much bigger? Is joy conditional? Does it depend on certain conditions? Does joy depend on time and place? Does it depend on age? Are children more joyful than adults? Are the elderly more joyful than the middle-aged? Is joy conditional? Time, place, age? Is it conditional on wealth? Can a poor person be joyful? Is it dependent on status? Can a humble peasant be as joyful as a master of the universe? Does it depend on gender, race, religion? And the last question to consider is, can you make it? Can you make joy? Can you do it? Can you build it? Can you create it? Or is it simply discovered? Where? When? How? That's the start of an inquiry into the nature of joy. Now, if we had time, we'd split into small groups of three or four, and we'd start discussing those questions. And it's a really good conversation to have. And perhaps there'll be a chance to do something like that at some other time. But just the consideration of them is enough to stimulate a little bit of wonder about the nature of joy, about what it is, how it's caused, where it comes from, what its results are. Now, clearly, everybody in the room here has come. I assume everybody knew before they came what joie de vivre meant. So you're just not coming blind. So there was something attractive about the notion of it. And joy in its very nature is utterly attractive. Utterly attractive. It's had a long history. A history of happiness. Those sorts of questions that we entertained just then have been asked time out of mind in cultures all over the world. Now, in the West, we're a baby compared to some cultures, so our time out of mind wondering only goes back to 2,500 years. Democritus, Plato, Socrates, Epictetus. In around 325 BC, a young man celebrated his 16th birthday. 325 BC, not so long ago, 16th birthday, and his father gave him a book for his birthday. And it was a book that he'd written himself for his son. Now, the boy's name was Nicomachus, and his father's name was Aristotle. And the Nicomachean Ethics has formed the backbone of study for philosophers and ethicists and logicians and academics for 2,500 years. It had a huge impact on church thinking during the Middle Ages. Thomas Aquinas called Aristotle, capital T, the, capital P, philosopher. And this was a birthday present for his son at 16. Now, I'm not so sure that the 16-year-old Nicomachus thought as highly of the book as ethicists, logicians and philosophers did. He was only 16, and like most 16-year-olds, he probably got trapped in chapter 10, which is on pleasure. So that was probably where the focus of his attention went. And like all 16-year-olds, he probably didn't get the chief message that his dad was trying to give to him, that happiness comes from a measured, well-ordered life. The Greek idea was arete, excellence. And happiness is the result of excellence of ethos. Hence we have the word ethics. Excellence of character. So arete, excellence of character. So that was the chief idea behind the Greek approach to happiness, that happiness comes from a measured, well-ordered, regulated life. And once that gets into the hands of professional academics, ethicists and philosophers and others, it becomes regulated into an incredibly onerous system and not very attractive for a 16-year-old and not very attractive for those of us who have a desire to realise the reason we were born, joy. Not many of us are going to sit in a dry old university room studying a textbook and analysing its sentence structures in order to find joy. It's not going to happen. The general idea of the Greeks that happiness is an excellence that comes through excellence of character. Now, this lasted a long time for us in the West, and I have no intention of spending the morning going through a long, detailed history of theories of happiness in the West, but there's one that sticks out. Benedict de Spinoza, nearly 2,000 years later, told a terrific story about this pursuit of excellence of character. He was the son of a very successful merchant. So he had plenty of time to think and to write. He dedicated himself to philosophy and, of all things, optics. So he had plenty of time to think. And one day, he was an independent young man. Oh, he was in his 30s when he started doing this. But he was independent. He had no reliance on anybody or anything. He could do what he liked. And one day, he was reflecting on how much joy he took in particular things and how sweet it was. And he asked himself, is it possible that there's such a thing as unending, unchanging, utterly stable happiness? Does such a thing exist? I get all these little bits of happiness from these things, but is it possible to find unending, unchanging, completely perfect happiness? So what did he do? Well, he was a reasonable fellow. The first thing he did is he took an audit of the things that gave him happiness there and then. A complete audit. He catalogued the lot, and he was quite meticulous in his cataloguing. But finally, he grouped them under three headings, that there were three basic things that gave him some happiness. The first was pleasure, of course. The pleasure provided some happiness, and while he actually saw its limits, at least it provided some happiness. Pleasure. Second thing was honours. The recognition of others and the happiness that this gave. And the third thing was wealth, of course, because wealth gave him the freedom to pursue the things that made him happy. So these three things. So Spinoza was living in the 17th century, so he talked about pleasure, wealth and honours. Nowadays we'd call it sex, money and power. And it was the same thing. Pleasure, wealth and honours. Now we've reduced that somewhat, because pleasure, wealth and honour sounds a little bit more dignified than sex, money and power, but it's the same drill. Three things. Now, what Spinoza said was, these three things give me some happiness. So I'm not going to jettison them. I'm not just going to toss them aside. They give me some happiness. But I am going to try and find out if there is such a thing as perfect, unending, unchanging happiness. And if there is, how to get it. Now, he spent a long time. He worked that question for years, really, for years. He worked it systematically and with lots of vigour, and along the way he had profound experiences of joy. And he made this observation, that the more he approached perfect, unending, unchanging happiness, the less attracted he was to pleasure, wealth, and honours. They were irrelevant. They paled into insignificance. It's very encouraging for us to hear an observation of that depth from somebody who dedicated an enormous amount of time to the pursuit of happiness. Now, the marketplace and our daily lives will keep encouraging us to engage in the pursuit of pleasure, wealth, and honours, because that's the currency of the day. But to be duped by those into thinking that they're going to fulfil our purpose in being born, to discover joy, perfect, unchanging, unending happiness, is to be badly duped. So occasionally we need to come together in forums like this and review where we're at and where we're going. There's a beautiful story about joy. In the story, a swan, a white swan, has got to get to Lake Manasarowar. Manasarowar, it's a lake at the base of a mountain in the Himalayas. It's a natural lake. It's the largest freshwater lake, highest freshwater lake in the world. And the story goes that the swan has to get to the lake at the base of the mountain in the Himalayas. It's a very, very difficult journey to get there, and only a great swan can do it. Once there, he has to dive deep into the lake to find precious white pearls of bliss upon which he feeds. That's his goal, to find and feed on those white pearls of bliss at the bottom of the lake. Now, the Sanskrit word for swan is hamsa. The Sanskrit word for a great swan is paramahamsa. And it's a title that's often given to great sages. So hamsa is also translated as soul. So the swan is an image of the human soul in its most pure and perfect state. Ramakrishna was called a paramahamsa, and other saints have been called paramahamsas since. And the idea is that in the same way as the swan, the individual has pearls of bliss hidden in the ocean of his being, and it takes resilience and strength and knowledge to make the journey, to get there, and to find the pearls. Now, all that, resilience, effort, discipline, sound a bit hard, and there's a bit of the ancient Greek idea in it. Now, the story's good because it's inspiring, but joy, the joy that we're after, is now. It's not then, it's not after I make the journey, after I find the pearls, after I get to the bottom of the lake, it's now. And the reason that this talk was called Joie de Vivre rather than happiness or the pursuit of bliss was to capture the idea of happiness imminent now, like water soaking through wood, imminent through everything, here and now. Not something which will come at the end of a long stage, not something that will come as the result of a systematic effort, but not for the future, but for now. There's this huge happiness industry booming all over the world. Have you noticed? Bookshops are groaning. Everybody's competing for our happy dollar. And look, there's been some terrific work done, for example, in the area of positive psychology. The University of Pennsylvania has done some remarkably effective studies in a new field, which they've called positive psychology, which is really about the measured discovery of happiness. And you can go to the website and you can take a number of tests to assess your level of happiness. And each one of the tests is classified according to your well-beingness, your love of life, your social circle, your dependence on external things rather than dependence on yourself. There's a whole series of questionnaires, and I really encourage you to have a look at some of their stuff. So it's interesting. But there is a great happiness industry booming. People are looking for happiness. And it's an odd thing. When I was younger, somebody tried to tell me that the only reason I did anything was in the pursuit of happiness. And I disagreed with them. I said, no, I'm after knowledge. I don't care about happiness. I don't care whether I'm happy or not. I want knowledge. A little while ago, I realized they were right. It's an important realization. It has all kinds of ramifications across what we do, how we do it, and why we do it. But we'll come to that a little bit more later. Whatever he does it for bliss. What about all the atrocities committed around the world? Surely a person committing those can't be doing it for bliss. How can that be so? Well, at best, it's just thoughtless action. But at the very worst, it's willful, deliberate, conscious ignorance. thoughtless action can be rectified, willful, deliberate, conscious ignorance can be educated. Realizing this, that whatever anyone does, anyone, it's done for bliss, is a transformative realization for two reasons. And the very first one is, it connects us with everybody else. Whatever I do, I'm doing for bliss. Whatever anybody else is doing, they're doing for bliss. We're all doing what we're doing for bliss. And in that connection, maybe the connection extends further. Maybe the stars are shining for bliss. Maybe the earth is turning for bliss. Maybe the rivers are running for bliss. Maybe it really is for bliss. The second reason it's so transformative is this. I can then test everything that I do against my goal. So every action that presents itself for me to do, I can ask, is this for bliss? Every speech that I make, is this for bliss? And it's not just my bliss. It's a wider bliss. It's the bliss that runs through everything. The answer to that question, is this for bliss, is immediate. It's always immediate and it's always right. And then all we need to do is to have the strength to follow what we know to be true and start to feed on the pearls of bliss. Now, there's a very lovely story in the Taittiriya Upanishad describing these pearls. The Upanishad is sometimes really difficult to understand, but we have guidance from Shankara, who interprets the Upanishad for us. And he explains this section called the bliss that is absolute in the most beautiful way. So the Upanishad describes the world as beginning in joy. That's how it starts. And then it asks the question, what is joy? Now, we've approached this question in a particular way and we've asked them questions of ourselves and reflected on it. What the Upanishad does is this. Imagine a young man, well-read, ambitious, firm, strong, noble. Give him all the wealth of the world. Call him one unit of human joy. You got the picture? One unit of human joy. A person combining youth, beauty, wisdom, high aspirations, firmness of character, great physical strength and energy, creative power, intelligence, profound nobility, and profound wealth, all in one. One unit of human joy. Now, this is the coincidence of internal and external circumstances, a perfect combination of good genes, good circumstances, good luck, and not many people have all these attributes of joy at the same time. Now, I tried to put this into perspective. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was very young, I used to do what-if dreams. Now, can we turn this one unit of human joy into a current notion of human joy? So I'm going to give you mine first, and it's a bit embarrassing, but you know, here it is, and then we can modify it if you like. So, the body of Hugh Jackman. Maybe he's too old. I'm going male here, all right? We'll get to the girls in a minute, and I'm not even going to go there. I'm not going to go there, so we'll stick with this. So the body of Hugh Jackman, the mind of Einstein, the ambition of Alexander the Great, the nobility of Gandhi, the Mandela, and the wealth of Bill Gates. Any modifications on that? Anybody make any suggestions? Single. It's not in the Upanishad, but it sounds pretty blissful. So did you ever have dreams like that? Did you? Not just like that, but sort of that sort of idea? I mean, everybody's subject to it. And the Upanishads got this beautiful description. Now, the thing about the Upanishads, and the difficult thing about them, but the beautiful thing about them, is that they're concentrated. They're concentrated, so you've really got to give yourself to the Upanishad completely. It's a perfect concentration. And it's gloriously concentrated, so you really do need to sort of soak yourself in it. So the Upanishad, and this is W.B. Yeats' translation. If I read you the literal translation, it would be a whole lot more complicated. But this is the W.B. Yeats' translation. Think of a young man, well-read, ambitious, firm, strong, noble. Give him all the wealth of the world and call him one unit of human joy. Now, what the Upanishad's doing really beautifully is it's giving us something that we're familiar with, and it's trying to get us to get some understanding of absolute bliss. Because remember, this is a section on absolute bliss. So it starts where we're at. Very compassionate. No one knows who wrote the Upanishads. They're a natural outpouring, a revelation, and they've sustained humanity for thousands of years. So it's very compassionate. So it starts with where we are, our usual dream of what human bliss is. And that's a pretty good picture. If you had all those characteristics, you could be fairly confident you're going to be happy, wouldn't you? You know, don't think about it too much, but you'd be fairly confident you'd be happy. Especially if you were single. But, you know, no. I have to be careful with my wife in the front row. Now, this is one unit of human joy. So this is a particle of bliss in human form, this ideal thing. And it's only an approximation. Now, we're trying to approach absolute bliss. So is that our starting point? No. What the Upanishad then does is it says, multiply that bliss 100 times. Now, I don't know if you can get the feeling for that. But multiply that bliss 100 times. And the Upanishad says, this is one unit of the joy that belongs to supernatural beings possessed of remarkable powers and complete mastery over the entire subtle world. Now, I don't know how many of us have had dreams about becoming a supernatural being with complete mastery over the subtle world and remarkable powers like disappearance and instantaneous manifestation, but you can imagine the joy. And starting with that perfect idea of joy that we just conceived, one unit of human joy, multiply that 100 times, and you have the joy of these supernatural beings. Does this get us close to absolute bliss? No. This is only one unit of joy of a different kind of being. We have to multiply that joy 100 times. Does this get us anywhere near bliss absolute? No. The expansion continues and continues and continues and continues, and the Upanishad describes the joy at each one of these points of expansion. 100 times the one before, 100 times the one before. 10 times to the power of 100. That's even more than America's debt. 100 times, 10 times, have I got that right? 10 times to the power of 100, 100 times to the power of 10. 100 times to the power of 10. 100 times to the power of 10. And at that 10th step, we've got the combined joy of all the universes that have ever existed, not just this one, all of them that have ever existed, all of them that exist now on all the levels that they exist on, and all of the universes that will ever exist. One unit of joy of all of that. And that's just a particle of bliss compared to bliss absolute. Just a fragment. So how do you approach such a thing as bliss absolute? Well, I left something out. Let's go back to this one unit of human joy. One unit of everything that we value as human beings, the ability to know whatever we want, the ability to control whatever we want, the ability to, the intelligence to direct, choose well, to have the power and the vitality and the wealth to satisfy whatever desire we can think of. And that's a really good description of how we think of complete joy. Now, the thing I left out of the Upanishad was this. Right at the beginning, after it describes one unit of human joy, it says, a man full of revelation but without desire has equal joy. And for each one of the descriptions of the units of joy, up to the tenth, it finishes with a man full of revelation but without joy, without desire, has equal joy. A man full of revelation but without desire has equal joy. Now, a man full of revelation but without selfish desire, without the desire that sullies the being. A man full of revelation but without selfish desire has joy equal to the combined joy of all the universes that are here now, have been in the past, will be in the future. A person who sees things as they are, a man full of revelation, a person who sees things as they are. Things have been revealed to him. He sees things as they are, and he's unmoved by desire. He has absolute bliss. So the answer is really simple. Joy is the very stuff of the universe. It's natural and it flows through everything. And we experience it when we're completely ourselves, when we're at ease and we're free from the world of wanting and becoming and doing and knowing, just at ease with ourselves, there's joy. We get a glimpse of how things really are. And when we do get a glimpse of how things really are, we find that they're full of joy. So we're going to practice a little exercise, and it's the exercise that people do when they first come into the introductory course in the school, but there's going to be a slight variation on it. So if you could just follow the directions as they're given. Just begin by being balanced and upright. Now, don't be stiff or formal about that. Just be balanced and upright. Like a child is completely balanced and upright and at ease. No tension, no pressure. So banish any desire to experience anything or to achieve anything. Just let all that desire go and feel the weight of the body on the chair. Feel the pressure of the feet on the floor. Feel the pressure of the clothing on the skin. This is a sense of touch. Feel the air moving over the skin or in and out of the body. All of this is a sense of touch. Feel the weight of the clothing on your shoulders, down your arms, on your legs, shoes around your feet. Let all tensions go. All of this is the sense of touch. There is the sense of touch, and there is awareness of the sense of touch. Let the sense of touch go and rest in the awareness itself. Just a moment. Now, be aware of the sense of smell. The scent that can be picked up. All the delicacies carried on that scent. There is a sense of smell, and there is awareness of the sense of smell. Let the sense go and try and stay with the awareness itself. Just for a moment. Now, the sense of taste. Be aware of the sense of taste. The tongue is a living organ, carrying the sweetness and the bitterness of all taste. There is the sense of taste, and that sense can be subtle. Some people are said to have good taste or bad taste. The taste that we have in the music that we listen to, the friends that we keep, all of this, the sense of taste. There is a sense of taste and awareness of the sense of taste. Leave the sense and try and rest with the awareness. Now the listening. Let the listening receive all sound, the sound of this voice, the sound of the air conditioning unit as it operates, the sound of traffic outside, the gentle sounds in the room, bodies moving, adjustments being made. Let the listening receive all sound. There is the sense of hearing and awareness of that sense. Let the sounds go and stay with the awareness itself. Rest content in your own joyful presence, free of any desire. Let things be as they are. Now, this is an intimation of simple joy. Sure, it's not exciting. It doesn't make any noise. It makes no claims. There's no agitation about it at all. But without that, without a taste of that, then we lose hope and we lose courage. The world looks completely different in this state. It's not contained inside me. If anything, I'm contained in it. It's imminent, it's pervasive, it's running through everything. And it begins to reveal itself for what it really is. So that's the beginning of revelation. Shantananda Saraswati described this as follows. Joy without an object is bliss, which exists by itself. It is never caused, and that is the reason why it has no object from which it could arise. It is universal and ever-present. When impediments are cleared, then direct experience of bliss becomes a reality. It is very peaceful, and there is no obvious reason for it. It simply glows and does not move. Now, as I said, no excitement, no movement, no agitation, but it's nourishing at a really profound level. And we've just had a tiny, tiny, tiny glimpse of it. Now, the idea is to become expert in diving into it, in living in it. The idea is to move in its fabric, to be aware of it through the course of the day. And we can't do that if we're constantly occupied by the pursuit of some particular habitual sense pleasure. It overshadows it. So like Spinoza, we need to not disband them, not jettison them, but to put them there and examine them in the light of this other thing. See what happens. when we're connected with that joy, it doesn't mean that we do nothing. This is a mistake which is often made when people start looking for absolute bliss, that in order to find it, I've got to separate myself right away from everything and everyone else, cut myself off from the world. So monasteries start, and people seek some kind of monastic life, cutting themselves off from the world. But completely cutting yourself off isn't possible, because the senses will make their demands, and the mind will make its demands, and the intelligence will make its demands. It's impossible to cut off. So you either make up an imaginary blissful world to live in, or you say there's no such thing as bliss. So neither of those two actions to try and find bliss, segregate oneself off or negate the bliss, neither segregation nor negation work. The reason for the joy being there is to impregnate life with purpose, hope, courage, and energy. Connection with that joy energizes life. The first fruit of that connection with joy is love. And the second is courage, and the third is hope. So connection with that joy doesn't mean you don't do anything. Connection with that joy means that your life suddenly has a purpose. It has reason. It's got a direction. Whatever presents itself to you is also seeking bliss. Engage with it. Unite with it. Work with it. Whatever it is. Stop wishing that you were the CEO of some huge financial institution, master of the universe, instead of being a school teacher. Stop wishing that you were something other than what you are, but find what you are and let that find its function in that joy. Now, as we're drawing to a close, there's one other statement from Shantananda Saraswati which I'd like to leave you with. Those who have love in their hearts and reason in their minds act in unison, for they feed on bliss. So the idea is to bring together love in the heart and reason in the mind so that the being can act in unison, instead of the heart feeling one thing and the mind thinking another and bliss being obscured by all the confusion. Those who have love in their hearts and reason in their minds act in unison, for they feed on bliss. Well, you've done really well. I think we'll stop there for some refreshment. You have done very, very well. But in the meantime, we'll have a cup of tea and some refreshments outside. So thank you very much.